I'm just going to put a number up there for a while. But here's the deal. There are, this week, 10 children in the child care and preschool. And we have been open for 10 weeks at the end of this week. So that means we have averaged one child a week. And you need to pray that we continue to grow in that fashion. It's good. One of the privileges I have been given by Chris Wolf, our director, is that I can go down there pretty much any time. She doesn't like me to come during nap time. She really doesn't like me to come when she's trying to teach them something, or the teachers are. But I'm allowed to come down there and see them kids every once in a while, and I do that. I'm getting to know them by name, and it's the coolest thing when you go down there. I've noticed this about these kids. And I'm just going to walk through the ones that I can remember in my head right now and give you an idea how they greet me on a particular day that I saw them this week. Little Kaya. Little Kaya is 3.5 years old, and little Kaya says, "Hey, hey, hey, look at me, hey, 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 look at me." And then she'll say, "Watch this, watch this." And she'll dance around, do something like this, "Hey, hey, hey." And she wants my attention. There's that little Michael. Little Michael, no matter what he's doing, he could be coloring on something. And Pastor Joel walks in the room, and he says, "Watch how fast I can run." And he looks up, and he wants me to see what he's done. There's little Ja'Kai. Now, Ja'Kai comes over this week, and Ja'Kai says, "Pastor Joel, do what I do." And he did a cartwheel. I said, "I don't think I'm going to do a cartwheel, Ja'Kai. That's not going to be what Pastor Joel does." Little Valerie, she doesn't say a word. She picks up her little color book, little paper that she's painted. She comes over and says, and she goes back. All of those little kids come. I could go on. I thought about it before. I stepped up here this morning, thought about it this week. They want to show you, wouldn't matter if it was me or you, they want to show you what they can do. I want to go through this scripture real quick again with you just for a minute this morning so that you can get a feel for what's going on here. They came to the crowd, and a man came up to Jesus and knelt before him, and he said, "Lord, have mercy on my son. He has seizures, and he suffers terribly, so terribly that sometimes he falls into a fire, and sometimes he falls into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, and they could not heal him." Jesus says, "Oh, faithless and twisted generation." You know, sometimes Jesus, you know, he could have just left that at faithless, couldn't he? But he had to throw in the word twisted. "Oh, faithless and twisted generation, how long do I have to be with you?" And then he says, "How long do I have to bear with you?" There's a difference. "Bring him here to me." I want to point out to you that this gentleman made the statement, and Jesus answers and says, "Oh, faithless and twisted generation, how long will I be with you? How long will I bear with you? Bring him to me." We could say that Jesus was saying that to this man, but that's not what's going on. He is saying this to his disciples. We don't know what has changed the game, but something has changed the game. He's talking about their faith. He calls them faithless. They've lost their belief in something. And then he uses that word twisted, which means deviate from what is right or moral or good. Jesus asked this question: how long do I need to be here? He's asking the question, how long do I need to stay with you, disciples? And secondly, he says, and here's why I pointed it out earlier, it's a different question. How long do I have to put up with you? It's not just how long do I have to be here with you, but how long do I have to put up with you? Did you ever go to something you didn't want to go to? Did you ever have your spouse, I've had this happen, she'll say, "We're going to, you know, a work party or this, that, or everything, and I just don't want to go." And you get there, you know, and the whole time you're there, you're saying, "Man, wow, how long do I have to do this?" Jesus is saying to his disciples, how long do I got to stay here? And how long do I have to stay here and put up with you? And then Jesus rebuked the demon. Now, I want you to stop for a minute and understand that last verse, that was actually Jesus rebuking the disciples, just so you know. Now he's rebuking the demon. even. And it comes out, and this boy is healed, I love the word, instantly. You need to get the nuance of that word. Instantly means that quick. But there's more than that. It's that quick, but get this, it's in the nick of time. It's at the most critical moment. This boy who had some demon possession or something going on with him where he had seizures, we don't know. It's said one way and the other in this passage. Things had gotten worse. It was bad enough that when he had him, he threw himself around. Sometimes he fell into fire. Sometimes he fell into water. But something happened that it was getting worse. And this word instantly nuances it to say that Jesus did it that quick and exactly when it needed to be done. It seems that everybody kind of clears out. I don't know, but the disciples somehow get alone with Jesus. And they come to Jesus and they say, Jesus, ask yourself, why can't we do what Jesus does? Think about that for a minute. And it's really important for the disciples. Because back in Matthew 10, Jesus had given them the authority to do this very thing. In fact, they'd done it before. But remember, I told you something's changed. Now suddenly they can't do it. And they're asking Jesus the question, why can we now not do what we've previously done? What has changed? I want to point this out to you. Jesus threw that demon out, right? Jesus hasn't changed. So their question has to do with themselves. Why could we not cast it out? What has changed with them would be the proper question. And Jesus answers the question, because of your little faith. For I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you'll say to the mountain, be moved from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. Little faith. I wonder if Jesus didn't say that with a little bit of tongue-in-cheek. He says, little faith. Have you ever had, you ever seen a mustard seed? Have you all seen a mustard seed? I thought about getting some to pass out, but I hope you all saw one. I forgot to get a picture of one. I mean, they're just a tiny little seed, a little ball. Jesus, with tongue in cheek, says, I want to answer your question is because you don't even have as much faith as a mustard seed. Your faith is so tiny and it's so small. That's why you couldn't do it. Now, back when this father brought him, he used the word terribly. He said, Jesus, he suffers terribly. This was a severe problem. It was an irregular problem. And it was a real issue. He's thrown into the water. He's thrown into the fire. It's difficult to take my son anywhere. I want you to know that I don't think this father was complaining when he said your disciples couldn't cast him out. But I do think that this man had an expectation. I don't think he was being critical of the disciples. He was just stating a fact. Because it wasn't just the disciples. If you had a son like this, you'd take him anytime, anywhere, to anybody that could offer you hope. See, the problem is nobody, disciple or not, had been able to heal this boy. The problem with this is, back in 10:8, Matthew 10:8, Jesus had said to his disciples, heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. They'd done it before. So there was an expectation here on the part of this man that they'd do it again. But more important than that expectation, I believe, listen close, it wasn't just the expectation of the father that they would be able to cast the demon out. I think they had their own expectation that what we've done before, we can do again. And this father's disappointed. I'm actually not sure the disciples were disappointed as much as they were surprised. Jesus had said, hey, you're going to do great things. And they did them. But suddenly something's changed. This boy is brought to them. He's in a bad way. They could not cast the demon out. said before, it came easy. What happened? What was different? Why wasn't it now? Talking about the benefit of the doubt this morning. I'm going to talk for a few minutes, if you've been here the last few weeks, about some passages that are going to sound familiar from the past 2 weeks, but they're critical. Context is everything, right? You'll remember 2-3 weeks ago was Transfiguration Sunday. We talked about Jesus taking Peter, James, and John up onto that mountain, and there appears Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus, and Peter says, you know, I want to build these three temples, or three tents for you, these three tabernacles, whatever they were. And it's important that you understand this context. Because just before that transfiguration, Jesus has this conversation with his disciples. Hey, who do people say I am? And they said, well, some say you're, you know, Elijah. Some say you're one of the prophets. But who do you say that I am? Peter speaks up and says, Lord, you're the Christ. You're the Son of the living God. Jackpot! Hey, you know, I'm craving that nutty dog of mine. He gets hot dogs for treats. He gets one hot dog for everything he does right. You know what jackpot is with a dog? Does anybody here know what jackpot is? Jackpot is he gets a bunch of treats. Okay? When he does something that's really high dollar, high value, I give him a whole load of hot dog pieces. Jackpot! Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, jackpot, Peter! You've got it! You understand now. You got it right, Peter! You have not had this taught to you by some seminary professor. God revealed it to you. And Peter, because you got it, I'm going to build my rock, my church upon you, because you are now the rock. And Peter, what you bind in heaven will be, or on earth will be bound in heaven. What you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Peter, you finally got it. And then Jesus says to everybody, immediately he says, I'm going to go down to Jerusalem. They're going to crucify me there, and I'm going to die. Peter says, no way. No way. It's not going to happen. What I want you to see, church, is this. There is this roller coaster going on here. One minute, Peter got it all right. The next minute, Peter says, Lord, far be it from you to be crucified and buried. And Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. Up here, Peter's here. And the very next minute, Peter's down here. One minute, Peter's up on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus. Get this, church, everything I just told you, the Peter deal, the crucifixion deal, the transfiguration, all of that, it happens right before the passage that we're reading this morning. It's a roller coaster. You see, when Jesus comes down off the Mount of Transfiguration, the very first thing that happens is this father comes with his son and says, Jesus, I brought him to your disciples. They couldn't do anything with him. So please understand, 9 of these guys who had the authority to do it couldn't get the job done. I mean, think about it. We're up there, we're watching. All this go down, Moses, Elijah, and as soon as they come down the hill, here's the 9, they couldn't get the job done, nobody can. It's kind of like a roller coaster, isn't it? I'm up here, then I'm down here, I'm up here, then I'm down here. Talk about Elijah for a minute, and I know it's way off base, but it illustrates, I'm going to talk about Elijah and Moses actually, it illustrates well what I'm trying to get across to you today. A while back, I preached a series with you, and it had to do with Elijah, and you may recall this story, but let me just tell it to you real quick. Elijah goes up on Mount Carmel. 450 false prophets meet him there. You remember the story? They pile on the wood. There's this challenge made. If your God is God, let him come down and take the offering. If my God is God, he'll come down and take the offering. They pile up the wood. They throw on the offering. And those 450 prophets of Baal start crying out to God, their God, to Baal, you know, hey, set down fire, eat up this thing to prove who you are. And nothing happens. Elijah starts praying to God, right? What's God do? Fire out of the sky comes down, takes up the offering, takes up the wood, takes up the fire, licks up the water that they had poured in the ditch, and whoosh, it's back up to heaven. I want to tell you what now. I mean, you see that? Yeah, that's my God. Uh-huh, yeah, that's my God. You know what happens next? Jezebel. He says, you know what Elijah did? He went up there and his God licked up that offering and he had all your prophets killed with the sword. And Jezebel is fuming. I got to tell you, Ahab may have been king, but Jezebel was running the ship. Jezebel's mad. Jezebel says, send this message to Elijah. Elijah, may the gods do more to me than they did to those prophets of mine up there on that hill, if I don't make your life just like theirs by tomorrow morning. What she has said is, I'm going to kill you before tomorrow. You're dead meat, Elijah, for what you did. And I want you to look at what Elijah does. He's afraid. He runs for his life. He comes to Beersheba. He leaves his servant there. He goes one day's journey into the woods, and he sits down under a broom tree, and he asks God if he can die. It's enough, O Lord, take away my life. What a miserable thing. What a pathetic way to celebrate. I mean, for crying out loud, you were just up on Mount Carmel. God came down and did prove who he was, came down and confirmed everything you've said about him. This is how you celebrate. Run out into the woods, get down under a tree and say, oh, God, just take me now. I can't take it. Jezebel's coming to kill me, and I don't know what I'm going to do. See that roller coaster? See that roller coaster? Stay with me. Moses delayed to come down the mountain, and the people decided, we're going to worship other gods. I mean, God just set us free from slavery, took us out through the wilderness, parted the Red Sea, did all that stuff, all those, but since Moses has taken 10 minutes too long up there in the mountain, we better start melting our earrings, making other gods so we can worship somebody. Here comes Moses down the hill. And Moses, listen to what it says in Exodus 32, the 19th and 20th verses. As soon as Moses came near to the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, Moses' anger burned hot. He threw the tables out of his hands, broke them at the foot of the mountain. He took the calf that was burned it with fire, ground it to powder, scattered it in the water, and made the people of Israel drink it. Can I tell you something? Moses is ticked. Jesus is up here on another mountain a long time later. We don't know how long he's up there at this transfiguration, but he's up there. And along comes this dad with a little boy who's got a demon and no one to heal him. And here are these 9 disciples of Jesus. Look at this man with his son, and they can't do anything about his circumstance. Let me stop and just, I'm going to take a little side road for a minute. 2004, you've all heard my story where I got sick and everything. But I've never told it from the doctor's perspective, this one moment. I want to tell it to you right now. They came into the room the day that I was really bad in 2004. Janice is there by my bedside with me. He basically says to us, it's game over, you aren't going to make it. And here I am laying in bed. Dr. Jeffrey Miller, he still works over at Oakland Hospital. Dr. Jeffrey Miller, pulmonologist, his father was a pulmonologist, ran that practice before him. He's got a long history at Oakland Hospital, and he's a great doctor and a good friend. He comes into my room, tells us what's going on. Janice says, I got to go make a phone call. She slips out of the room, and he is standing there just looking at me. Can I tell you, I didn't get it? I mean, I'm befuddled. What did he just say? And I said to him, can you, I got an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, a 12-year-old at home. Can you explain to me what you just said? And here I am laying in my bed. There's the window. It's the old MICU at Oakland Hospital. There's the parking lot across the street. And he walks away from my bed. He goes to the window. He says, you know, Mr. Adkins, I got to get tires on my car today. My car's sitting right there across the street. He says, I'm going to leave here today when I'm done work. I'm going to walk across the street, get in my car, and go get tires. He said, you know, when I walk across that street, a car could hit me. Said, that'd be the way I'd die. And he turned around and looked at me. He says, this is how you're going to die. And I can't do, and he used an expletive, I can't do a thing about it. I tried to think about that for a while. How did that make a doctor feel? I mean, his job is to make people better. His job is to save people's life. And he what it made him feel was right there in that last sentence. I can't do a thing. Nine disciples commissioned by Christ to go heal, cast out demons, do everything that they were doing, and here comes this guy with a son, and he says, I need you to fix my son. And here are these nine disciples, and they tried, but they couldn't get it done. Something has changed. This man's done everything he can do, and he comes to Jesus, and he says, Jesus, I came to your disciples, and at my wit's end, he's fallen into the fire, he's fallen into the water, he's going to drown or get burned up. Nobody can heal him, nobody can fix him. I took him to nine of your best, and they couldn't do anything about it. Jesus is just as angry as Moses was about that golden calf, and he is just as angry as Elijah was bewildered about Jezebel's words. Generation, how long do I have to be with you? How much longer do I got to put up with this? Bring the child here. And they bring him there. And Jesus casts out the demon. And the disciples come to him when nobody's around with this dumb look on their face. They say, Jesus, why couldn't we do that? Jesus is still just as upset as he was before, I think. Because of your little faith. If you just had faith like a grain of mustard seed, you could move a mountain. Nothing will be impossible for you. But you right now can't do anything. Why does Jesus say, how long do I have to stay? How long do I have to bear with you? Why does he put it in that? It's because he's tired of messing around. By this time, they should have had enough faith to do anything. Moses hasn't set down his backpack on the top of that mountain before the people of God are melting their ear rings. Elijah hasn't come down from that event with those 450 prophets of Baals. He hasn't been at sea level for 30 seconds before he's running for the woods. Jesus steps out of the play for 5 minutes, and his entire group of understudies develop a bad case of, I don't think itis, I can do this. By this time, disciples, you should have learned something. By this time, you should have had the faith to know that you can do anything. But something happened. What happened? Church, I want to tell you. God's led them up out of bondage, across the Red Sea, all those things that happened to Pharaoh in Egypt, the Passover lamb. And they're out there in the wilderness, and they've got nothing to drink. Suddenly, they're conjecturing, well, maybe we should go back. We don't have anything to drink. I mean, he provided manna from heaven, and now they're worried about water. And Moses is talking to God, and God says, Moses, go down and take your rod and touch the rock, and water will come out of the rock. So Moses goes down, and he gathers the people together. He's going to get water for them out of the rock, and he takes his staff. And get this, this is what's important. This is really important. This is so important. Moses says, oh, you rebels, how long must I put up with you? And he takes that staff and he whacks the rock. The water came out. God did what he said he would do. Moses didn't make it into the promised land, and I'll tell you why. Because he forgot it was God that produced the water. He thought it was something about the way he was doing things. He thought it was something about him. He thought it was something about the fact that he had done so much for God before. Remember who Moses is, Exodus 4. Hey, Moses, I want you to be my man to deliver Israel out of bondage. And Moses is saying, oh, but God, I can't even talk. I don't want to go do this job for you. I can't even speak. And God says, I'll give you air and it's no problem, but I don't want to do it. God says, you go, I'll be with you. And God has been with him the whole way. And suddenly, Moses forgot that it was God doing it all. And his faith was no longer apparently in God, but it was in his technique of whacking that rock. It was in his technique of telling them people how dumb they were. I told you the story of Elijah. I'm just going to remind you. You knew the life of Elijah. Elijah has been fed by a widow who had nothing, who was going to die. Elijah has watched God fill up that woman's jar, fill that cruse with oil. He was sent down to the brook called Cherith at the Cherith Ravine, and God fed him with ravens and the water that flowed. And when the water dried up, God let him out somewhere else where he could take care of him. God has seen Elijah through everything, and after watching what took place up on Mount Carmel, those 450 prophets are destroyed. God proves who he is. Suddenly, Elijah is scared to death because a woman named Jezebel says she's going to do something to him. Is Jesus upset coming down off that hill? You better believe it. How long do I have to put up with you? I've been teaching you for 3 years. How long do I have to endure this? How long do I have to hold your hand? Listen close, because this is where we get all messed up. If you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, we think, oh, it's quality or quantity, right? No, that's not what Jesus is saying. It's about where you place your faith. It's about where you place your faith. Those disciples apparently had misplaced their faith. Jesus says, your faith is messed up, brothers. You've got a little faith. If you had a little faith, you could move a mountain, but you've misplaced it. Did you ever misplace your car keys? I took my keys out of my pocket, and I laid them on that pew over there, and I can guarantee you that there's a 70% chance I'll walk back to my office today and have to come back and get those keys. We misplace things. The most dangerous thing is to forget that it's about Jesus and not us. When Moses struck that rock, he moved from trusting God to trusting himself. He moved from thinking it was about God to thinking it was about him, and that's a dangerous transition. When Elijah was worried about Jezebel hunting him down and killing him, he stopped trusting in God, and he started trusting in himself, and it's a dangerous transition. Church, when the disciples could not cast out demons to this boy, their faith was misplaced in believing it was, if it was to be, it was up to me. Instead of up to Jesus, and it's a dangerous transition. Most of the results result of transitioning or misplacing our faith from having it in Jesus to placing it in ourselves, and that's a dangerous transition. The truth is, the disciples couldn't cast out demons any longer when this man came along, even though they'd done it before, because they had placed their faith in Jesus before. But when he was up on that hill for a while, they forgot. I'm going to give you my bottom line here, and I hope that I can make sense out of it for you. A well-intentioned doubt is actually a misplaced faith. Some of you will know what I'm talking about, because you have trusted Jesus in some situation for some of the time, be it short or long. It has reached a crescendo, and it seems as if God has not done a thing. And you have decided, if it's to be, it's up to me. And what we're really saying when we say that is, I doubt that God is going to step in or can handle this situation. It's in my hands now. It's time for me to take control. Some of us here today have trusted God for years that he's going to change either our prodigal son or prodigal daughter's heart to return to him, but they don't. And we've determined that we've got to take that into our hands, and we become a nagging parent or an angry person. And it's a tough transition, a dangerous transition, because we're doubting what God can do and thinking that we can. You may have trusted for years that God will move your spouse or other significant person to know and trust him the way you do, but they haven't. And now it's got to be up to you to take the reins and push them into the kingdom. And you're doubting the ability of the God who looked at the thief on the cross and said, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." It's a dangerous transition. Some of us have served in thankless positions in the church, and there are plenty of them, for a very long time, and we've developed the thought that if it's to be, it's up to me, and lately the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak, so we're going to give it up and give it to someone else. And in that decision, we've hidden the message that it will only get done if we do it, because we know no one else will. And again, we're doubting God's ability to raise up in our place someone that he's been developing for so long. And it's a dangerous transition for us. God said, if you've got faith like a grain of mustard seed, you can say to that mountain, "Be moved," and it will be moved. Think about that. Wow. I got faith like a grain of mustard seed. I can move mountains. Listen, church. He did not tell you you could do anything. He said you could move mountains. The reason I'm here, the reason I'm saying that to you right now, is because this. Nothing that we can do in and of ourselves can turn the water into wine, can cast the demons out of a boy, can call down fire from heaven, or can save us from our sins. Nothing that we can do. Listen, only Christ can do that. And when we begin to take the reins into our hands and to think that if I'm just good enough or if I'm just right enough, then God's going to accept me because of how good I am and how right I am, we got our faith in a completely wrong place. We've got our doubt that Jesus can do it. Think about that. And we have to. Your faith cannot redeem you. Only Christ can do that. Your faith cannot forgive you. Only Christ can do that. But that's exactly why faith in him is so very important. It's not in us. It's not misplaced in Joel. It's not misplaced in my ability or my education or the letters behind my name. It's trusted in the man from Galilee who came from heaven to earth to die for my sins because he loved me. It's placing our faith in that. God can't handle this on his own. Those disciples, when they walked up to that little boy, they said, demons come out and nothing happened. They thought it was up to them. But only faith in Christ can move mountains. Only faith in Jesus can forgive sins. Amen. If you're here today and you've been trusting in yourself, if you're here today and you've been trusting that you can be good enough, right enough, well enough, smart enough, intelligent enough, clean enough, whatever enough, I hope you know that just isn't true. Just trust it in yourself. It's doubting, actually.